Hello and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature occasional interviews with some of the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Degeler. I am the head of media at TNW.
I'm Linnea Augen, senior editor at TNW, and joining us today is...
I'm Thomas McCauley, senior reporter at TNW, making my debut appearance on the podcast, so please take it easy with me.
Welcome.
Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
We're very happy to have you. You've been trying to make this happen for a while now, but since we are on different sides of a channel, it's been a little tricky to arrange.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Very happy to be here. And yes, I'm in the FT's office, our parent company, the Financial Times. It's a pretty fancy studio in London. And yeah, hopefully the audio quality is good enough for all our listeners across the channel.
Yeah, let's hope so indeed. And let's also hope that this is not the last time that join us for the show. So how's it been, Tom? How's everything been? What's been happening?
Yeah, it's been good. Been a sort of busy few weeks at work. And I've also been in the process of moving house, which has been a pretty miserable experience, but not one I'd recommend repeating. Although obviously we all have to do it occasionally, but I'm going to try and do it less regularly in future because 2 in 1 year is really more than I would.
Yeah, they say it's one of the most stressful events in life, really, moving house.
Yeah, exactly. So try and find a nice house so you don't have to do it too often would be my advice.
Linnea, do you think you will ever have to move again?
Yes, absolutely. I think we're quite tired of, when we both work from home, of sitting across from each other at the kitchen table now. So we will be looking into at least getting an extra room to use as an office within the near future.
Would you like one office for two people or an office per person?
I think we can share one office because we also do go to the actual office at times. So.
Right. Yeah, no, it's pretty much the same for me, but I really don't hope that I won't have to move again.
We do. We might need an extra gaming room at some point, but we'll see.
Okay, what else? Yeah. A library?
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah, maybe a little outdoor, space where I can like meditate and quiet in the morning. Yeah.
So, Tom, how long do you expect to stay at the place you are now?
Well, I am fortunately the owner, fortunately or unfortunately, I suppose, depending on how things work out. I think I'm going to be there in the long term. I really like the area. It's parts of London that I like. You don't get much for your money there, but you don't get much for your money anywhere in London. So I think I've got it as good as I'm going to get it for a while.
Okay, so at least it's not going to be very stressful in the coming years, as you won't have
to. No, hopefully not. Yeah, touch wood.
Great. Once again, Tom, welcome. And it's great that you've been able to join this time. And I really hope that you will join us again in the coming weeks. So let's move on. We've got a whole lot of stuff to talk about. So today's episode, we are going to discuss Ukrainian startups, drones, information security, European quantum landscape, a reverse brain drain situation in Europe, and a lot more. In addition to that, you will also hear an interview with Michiel Schäfer, the president of the board of the European Innovation Council. So, Tom, you are the star of this episode, and we really wanted you to pick a story that you covered over the week and tell us more about it. And just what jumped at you? What was the most interesting thing?
Sure. Well, I suppose as it's my first appearance on the podcast, I was hoping you'd give me a little bit of leeway here to mention two stories. And I promise it's not just purely for shameless self-promotion. There's actually a reason, which is that they're both very interconnected. One was published last week and the other will be published over the next few days. And the link between them is that they both concern Ukrainian startups that produce what are known as dual-use technologies.
So for listeners like me, actually, who aren't familiar with the term, what does dual-use technologies mean?
Sure. So dual-use essentially means that the technologies can serve two purposes, military or civilian. Unsurprisingly, they've become particularly prominent in Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion began 2 years ago. And startups in the country are searching for applications and revenues from both defense sector clients and civilian customers. So a lot of these technologies will be created for defense technology, but then they'll try to find ways to redirect them towards other commercial applications. And in my case, the two stories that I covered, they involve two distinctive dual-use technologies, drones and information security. I'll start with the latter because that's the subject of the piece that's already been published last week, which focuses on a startup based in Kyiv called Osavol. I don't know if I've pronounced that incorrectly, Andre. It's your native...
Almost, it's Osavol.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Good to know. So the company was launched in response to the 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and its founding mission was to combat information warfare by applying large language models to the open web, social media, and online communities. These models are trained to predict, analyze, and interpret global news trends. So that could involve some kind of, it could involve a vast variety of different things. And in this case, what they focused on and what I focused on in my most recent piece was about using these large language models to identify trends in discriminatory language in Russian media. To do this, Osavul surveyed 5,000 sources from a Russian segment of the internet that encompassed news sites, as well as a whole gamut of social media platforms, from Twitter and Telegram and Facebook to a popular platform in Russia called VK. And from those channels, they collected messages by keywords that related to racism or xenophobia. And what they found was that the racist terminology has changed significantly in online discourse over the past year.
What does that mean? How exactly did it change? Like, what's different from the usual unpleasant stuff you can see on the internet?
Sure. So a lot of the terms used are concealed by slang or double meanings, which makes them very hard for non-native speakers to understand. And the researchers at Osavul suggest this is often deliberate. It's also used by politicians at times to sort of conceal their true intentions. For instance, the most common recent slur they found translates to foreign specialist, which is used ironically to mock the qualifications and education levels of migrant workers. And another interesting discovery that really stood out to me was how much the current events affect the use of this language. One example that stood out was a common insult that's used against Polish people and has been for a long time, but it peaked in usage when former Russian president Dmitry Medvedev posted a word on a Telegram post last August. And then after that, usage by other people surged for several weeks until Poland started blockading Ukrainian grain imports in September. And after that, the sightings declined again. So the correlation being, once people became more sympathetic towards Poland, so they stopped using that word.
Well, as much as this is a valuable societal service, keeping track of these things, I'm guessing that the startup is also looking into, like you said, transitioning it into a commercial use for its model.
Yeah, that's sort of the goal of the startup, exactly. So this project was mainly an attempt to raise awareness, but there are sort of growing number of avenues in which they can monetize this technology. Government is an obvious one, but also social media monitoring and corporate intelligence is a really growing market. And they are getting some funding now. Osavul recently raised 1 million euros in a seed round last year, which was led by a Ukrainian venture fund called SMRK. Yeah, and as well as the business plans and applications, I think the technology really fascinates me because it's so contentious. Like, people are justifiably uneasy about the control of information and who determines truth and censorship. And we've obviously seen a very prominent example of this in Elon Musk's plan for X, formerly Twitter. But then once you apply this LLM-based automated monitoring, flagging, and potentially takedowns of online conversations, it really adds another layer of concern about automated surveillance and censorship. But then on the other hand, yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just curious this is the kind of thing that the AI Act would be looking to contain.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's still sort of quite a few subtleties about how that's going to actually work out in practice. And I suppose also it kind of gets to the crux of the problem with the AI Act more broadly, which is finding that elusive balance between maintaining and promoting innovation and then protecting the public. And I think this is really a prime example of that. But I think also for all of the kind of controversies, it's also clear that whether this is used in information warfare or just social media moderation, there's a real demand and need for technologies that I think is only going to grow as our lives expand online. And yeah, if that's captured your interest at all in that broader topic of Julius technologies, I'd love to hear people's reactions to the next story I'm working on, which is, as I mentioned, about drones. I won't say too much before it's published, but it's a fascinating industry and one in which the military influences the commercial tech in applications ranging from filming movies to monitoring crops, but also one in which the commercial tech is influencing the military, which is particularly prominent in the more DIY-style drones used in Ukraine. But there are strong signs that trend is starting to change. So yeah, check out a piece this week to find out more.
Looking very much forward to reading it. And unfortunately, I believe this is the case with the current state of the world, that we will see more and more intersections between military and civilian technologies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And yeah, the drone warfare in general in the war in Ukraine, it has changed the war quite a bit as far as I can tell. And it is very likely to keep doing so. Tom, thank you so much for this. I'm very much looking forward to reading the story as well. So Linnea, before you read it, you probably will have to edit it as well.
Yes, but that's I look great. Very much forward to that as well.
Great. Now, let's move on to a story that we did not cover, Linnea, this week. It was your pick. So what did you think was the interesting thing?
Yeah, so we're staying a little bit on the international arena and the implication or the geopolitical implications of technology. And from one of my favorite topics last week of supercomputers, I'm moving to another of my favorite topics this week, which is quantum technologies. I will try not to speak as long as I did when talking about supercomputers.
That was interesting. It was fascinating.
Thank you. So an EU strategy on quantum technologies has been in the works for some time now, but on Friday, this past Friday, representatives from 20 European countries got together at the Belgium Institute of Natural Sciences to sign what is known as the Declaration on Quantum Technologies, or the Quantum Pact. And this was first presented by the Spanish presidency in December last year. But essentially, it is intended to, quote unquote, recognize the strategic importance of quantum technologies for the scientific and industrial competitiveness of the EU. And this means, I would say, that the bloc is really set on not getting left behind in yet another crucial technology race. In fact, the intention that has been stated is to make the EU the quantum valley of the world.
That sounds like an incredibly ambitious objective. Do you think, Linnea, it really stands a realistic chance, or is it a bit of a futile endeavor potentially?
Well, while I don't think it is even remotely possible to catch up to China in this field, it is true that China will by no means share its technologies with foreign industry, for example. So maybe it could, in a commercial sense, succeed, if not as a world leader in the tech itself. There are several European countries such as Denmark, France, and the Netherlands that already have national quantum strategies. And the EU, as a result, is home to about 25% of the world's small firms in quantum. And this is around 120 startups, which is about the same as in the US, actually.
So that's a good result.
Yeah. And these, of course, do not have the same kind of financial capabilities as the likes of IBM or Google and Amazon, who are some of the big tech frontrunners in quantum. And with very few actual current commercial applications for the technology, and VC funding obviously plummeting over the past years, they are really dependent on government support.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine that. But then again, so we have seen a whole lot of different declarations and pacts and everything else being signed over the past few years in different segments of technology. So it's all well and good. But how does the declaration actually intend to achieve the said goal?
Well, so there are five pillars to the strategy. And this is supporting startups and SMEs, investing in quantum research, enlarging the quantum investment pool, growing international cooperation. For example, there was a declaration joint with Canada a little while back stating that quantum is also within the range of technologies that the two will collaborate on, but also ensuring effective coordination at EU and member state level. Now, how this will actually look like in practice is a bit of a different story, but I'm looking very much forward to finding out. And I'm sure the quantum startups of Europe are as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But what do you think the startups actually need at this point? I mean, funding, obviously. Is there anything that's challenging for European quantum startups at this stage?
Well, I think something like this, just the recognition of what a crucial technology will be moving forward, because I think due to the lack of commercial application, quantum technologies they've been working sort of in the in the obscure areas of what will actually be important moving forward. And obviously AI has taken up all the spotlight. And so I think just this acknowledgement is already a very key step for companies moving forward, because also what they will need is to be able to attract highly skilled talent. And so for people going into their studies now, that can then emerge as experts in quantum computing and other quantum technologies a little further down the line. I think this is absolutely crucial.
Right. So all in all, positive news for European quantum ecosystem, yes, and startups in particular, which brings us nicely to the next segment of the podcast, which is This Week We Learned. And this time we decided to give the entire time of this slot to our guest star, Tom.
It's not that we didn't learn things this week. We're just generous like that.
Well, exactly. So, Tom, and I believe it has something to do with what we just discussed a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's more positive news. Well, it's positive if you're a supporter of European startups, at least, but perhaps not so positive if you're invested in the US tech sector. And this is actually something that Linnea put on my radar, which is a report in Venture Capital Journal, which is titled Why Tech Talent is Flocking to Europe. It sounds almost like a government-sponsored marketing campaign, but it has got some real data and analysis to back its central claim, which is that Europe has become the net beneficiary of tech talent movements between the US and Europe. One of the key pieces of evidence that they cite is a report by the VC firm Atomico, which covers the first 9 months of last year, and it made a couple of intriguing findings. The first was that just 20,900 workers left Europe for other reasons, while 30,500 moved into Europe from other places. The other finding, which interested me more, was that more tech talent moved from the US and into Europe than vice versa. It was a pretty marginal difference, 8,400 versus 8,300, but still striking given the obvious lure of the US tech scene and the apparent problems that we hear about very often that Europe supposedly has retaining domestic talent and also attracting talent from beyond the continent. Unsurprisingly, the report also found that founders are still raising way more money in the US, but that's evidently not the sole attraction for talent. And what Atomico identified as the biggest pull of Europe is the growth of what they call purpose-led companies, particularly in climate tech and sustainability. Atomico said this is having, quote, a magnetic draw upon talent. And given that
magnetic,
these sectors are now...
even.
Yeah. And it's a huge part of the reason for this sort of net beneficiary of talent that Europe has become. And given that these sectors are now quickly turning that ethical allure into powerful business cases, hopefully this is going to be a huge boon to European tech in the years to come as climate tech and sustainability become ever more crucial.
See, things are looking good for Europe. So I like our news today.
Yeah. So people go to the US for money and to Europe for purpose.
Yeah, that's probably the long and short of it.
Is that the motto we should put on the borders, EU borders,
yeah,
somewhere?
You should work for the Commission Marketing Agency, Andy.
Well, I would rather not. I would like. I like the Commission, but I would rather stay where I am. Thank you very much.
Good.
Speaking of the Commission, though, it is a great segue for us to move to today's featured interview. And this one is with Michiel Scheffer. He is the president of the board of the European Innovation Council. So I caught up with Michiel last week at the EIC Summit event in Brussels to discuss things like the status of the EIC Accelerator program, this year's priorities for the EIC in general. And also, since Michiel is a relatively new face in the organization, I really wanted to better understand his own priorities and vision for the organization moving forward. So here's the conversation in full. Enjoy and stay tuned. Michiel, thank you so much for joining the show. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Michiel, can we start a little bit with your own background? I know you've probably repeated this 10 times, 20 times over the past couple of days, but what is it that you did before starting as the board president of the EIC, and what is your role like now?
Well, my past has always been a combination of academic, business, and politics. Mm-hmm. So I have a PhD. I did a study on the first framework program of the European Union, on looking on the impact of technological change in the clothing industry, mm-hmm. and also in looking at globalization of the clothing industry. So I have already followed European policy since 1984. That's quite a long time. I'm getting 60, so that's the youngest one. So that's one line, and I've always continued to teach or to do thesis supervision over all the 40 years. The second background is I'm coming from a business background. Mm-hmm. My both grandfathers were CEOs. One of a technology company, the other one of a textile firm. So there's sometimes a textile history.
That's where the clothing industry comes from.
That's where the clothing industry comes as well. So the second one is, so I was working in an industry association. I set up a technology center when I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of, I had my own company helping companies to apply for European funding. So right. I wrote some 50 proposals, of which 17 were funded. So we were doing a decent job. And it's out of some, let's say, anger that only granting works and we should also invest in equity that led me to candidate for the regional parliament of the East Netherlands. And as a regional minister, I was promoting a kind of regional EIC system. Mm-hmm. So that's also where I learned how politically to set up a system like the EIC with blended finance mm-hmm. of grant and equity. So those are my three backgrounds. And I, because of my work, I've already, I speak five languages. Mm-hmm. And what also helps me, because of clothing and textiles and my background, I visited all the widening countries already in the 1990s. Right. So I know where some countries come from.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, and then you joined the EIC as the board president. What does it mean in practice? What do you do? What's your role like?
Well, it's a full-time job, and that's also because the commission was quite adamant and secure mm-hmm. in saying the president should not have any other activities. Well, then mm-hmm. you need to give him a full-time job, otherwise it's not feasible. So I would say that 20% of my time is literally preparing board meetings, chairing them, and assuring that the conclusions are implemented. But 80% of my work is an ambassador. Mm-hmm. So it's days like this, like the ESC summit days, but also going to information days in the country. So I go on the 4th of April, I have one in Vienna that also covers Czech Republic and Slovakia. Mm-hmm. On the 15th of April, I go to Vilnius where we have a Baltic information day. So I have a lot of time available to go into the countries, to go into the ecosystem, to understand them, to speak with our beneficiaries, but also to speak with our applicants that are preparing or that have unfortunately not succeeded in getting funding. Right.
And what is the function of the board? So how often does the board meet and what comes out of those meetings? What's the impact that the board has on the organization itself?
Yeah, the board is an advisory board. So it's not an executive board nor a supervisory board. It is an advisory board. It meets five times a year and blending in Brussels or in a member state. So we go two times in Brussels. So the tomorrow meeting on the 20th of March is in Brussels, but end of May we go to Slovenia, we go to Netherlands in the beginning of September, and next year we will go also in a blend of widening and non-widening countries. So five times a year we have working groups. They meet around twice, but in Teams, WebEx, about twice per meeting. So mm-hmm, they prepare mm-hmm. position papers for the board. And our main advisory role is to advise on a work program. So we have a compulsory role of advising on a work program, and we do that in three rounds. We make a scoping note. We say, okay, this is the direction we expect the program to go. We will discuss that scoping note tomorrow here in Brussels. Then we see a first draft. We will do that in May in Ljubljana. And then we see the final draft and we give a comment on that or a statement on that in September. That's right. The one core role. And the second core role is that we have a mandate to advise on a profile of the program managers, which is also guiding the instruments. So that's one bunch of things. And the other thing is we are, let's say, the representatives of the innovators. So we are really monitoring, how is the preparation of applicants? How is the application process? How is the evaluation? And how are the companies accompanied once they're funded? So we want to understand their journey mm-hmm. and we also observe the journey. So we also observe evaluations and also we feedback to the agency on how to improve the system.
Mm-hmm. So you've been around for a limited time by now. How long was it?
Well, the board exists. This board exists in 21. There was a pilot board before that, so some members have already been on the pilot board. I'm a startup within the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I joined 9 months ago.
Right. So, what What did you have as your first order priorities when you just joined? And have you been able to sort of push them within these first 9 months?
Well, the first thing, I mean, the EIC is the newest kid on the block in the in the Horizon program. So my first priority, also as a former politician, is to ensure that the system works well. Because if the system doesn't work well, you have no authority or legitimacy. That's one thing. And then a very important priority is from the onset, because when I started, the accelerator was not yet, let's say, mature or working, let's say, in a smooth way. I reached a lot out to beneficiaries. So I had from the onset a program of going around. So my first trip was to Bilbao end of April last year. I went to Dublin end of May last year. So even before I was formally contracted. So being close to the system is very important. So I travel a lot. I want to speak a lot. I'm active on LinkedIn to reach out and to go into dialogue, sometimes publicly, sometimes if it's delicate for the beneficiary or the applicant, let's say in a side stream. So understanding the system is quite important. And I think now it shifts a bit to, well, Europe is in a difficult situation with an aggressive power on our eastern border, with China being, let's say, increasingly technologically dominant, the US, which is an uncertain factor. I think the strategic autonomy of Europe is and the strategic identity of Europe is also more a priority. So are we not doing the things right, but are we also doing the right things?
Right. I see what you mean. And so you said that you embarked on this listening tour with beneficiaries. What did you learn? Like what was it like when you started, and what have you changed so far?
Well, it's very contrasted, because we have, let's say, a group of companies that have been funded, and they see the impact. So they see, well, they have some comments on the evaluation application, but they succeeded. So they were good in it. And they really like, well, the stamp makes a big difference. The funding makes a difference, because you can recruit people and you can really develop your technology. That helps as well. It's also the EIC is not only a funding tool, but it's also a community, like you see today. So they get into a grouping. So they really see the difference. Unfortunately, those who are not funded see it, of course, in a different way. And some see it, some accept that they have not been funded. I mean, I had the same experience. I got 17 projects funded and 33 not. So I had more pain than joy. And sometimes, okay, yeah, I understand. Sometimes you don't understand why your project is not accepted, and that's painful. So I'm also there to hear their pain and to either be blunt and say, well, I think you shouldn't try again, because yeah, your software as a service, that's not really deep tech. So don't try other tools, go there. Or really, yeah, you have something. Well, how can we help you improve?
Right. But then there was a third group, the ones that were accepted, but whose funding was delayed by a very long time at that point.
Yeah, that was a big issue, but that is solved by now.
Right. So that backlog has been cleared by now.
That has been cleared, but that was indeed a problem. And there's a guy who I was with in an FP6 project, so it was around 2010, and he was one of the applicants. And his procedure was, let's say, synchronic to my application process. Mm-hmm. And it took him very long. He was close to bankruptcy, but he got the money end of March last year, so he was saved. Yeah, that was a frustrating experience.
No, I can imagine.
Never again.
And now you have come up with this different structure with basically outsourcing parts of it. The due diligence is done by the EIB, if I'm not mistaken, and the fund management is by Alter Domus. What does it mean in practice? How does it work now? What's the difference?
Well, the difference, it's two different skills. Mm-hmm. And so the Commission, European Commission, has built grant funding agencies, and that's what they do well. They are not trained. No, they're not imagined, trained, and skilled to do grant, to do equity. So it is clever, and it is basically a mirror to what national banks do or regional banks do, like the one I managed politically in the east of the Netherlands. You set up a separate unit for the financial management of equity. It's a different skill. And basically, we have done that, or the Commission has done that, by doing the whole fund management part in the EIB Alter Domus duo, but the development part is still, and the business acceleration service is still with the agency. So that requires a very good cooperation. And so I was also with them 2 weeks ago, end of February. We had a joint session of the EIB staff and the EIC staff. That's a family of 120 people together. So it's quite a an instrument, let's say, and to exchange, okay, what are the logics? Because they think in a different way, they're trained in a different way, but it helps them to understand how the other works. Because what basically happens if you go as a beneficiary from grant to fund, you're handed over to the EIB, and the EIB then does the due diligence, which is a thorough process, and they will also determine the allocation of funding and follow up the syndication process. So those are a number of skills they do. And what is also important, what we also have developed, is that at all the big fairs, / Web Summit, I'm often there as well, we have a joint stand with the EIB so that basically applicants or beneficiaries that come around can see both teams at once. So we really want to work as one family, but we are cousins, but we work as one family.
Right. This makes a lot of sense. And this brings me to a point that you made in an interview before, I think, that basically everything, EIC, EIT, EIB, EIF, yep, it should be seen as one European brand by the entrepreneurs, for example, outside of this structure. But how can you make it happen? Because there's a lot of legacy of these parts of the European Commission working very differently in very different ways. Can it ever happen that they all become like this one sort of umbrella?
I think we ought to have done that. First, the formula of the cousins is not invented by me, but by an EIB director. So I'm very kindly quoting Jean-Christophe Laloux in doing this. So it's a spirit of family which is shared in the family.
There we go.
And the other thing is, I think it was my neighbor who was a retired civil servant who asked me, what are you doing now? I say, I work for this and this. Oh, you work for Europe? Yes, I work for Europe. So it doesn't make sense to do as if we are all kind of subclubs. We have one shared objective. We do that with different legal instruments, but we do it for, promoting Europe's autonomy and competitiveness, right, and quality of life.
Absolutely. And what is your own goal for this year? What are your own sort of KPIs? Not the ones that you report based on, but the ones that you look at when you're just like on your own in the evening at home. Like, how do you measure your work? What do you measure it against?
Well, I had a probation period, and on the 1st of March. So my first objective in the first 9 months was basically to understand the ecosystem well across Europe and to have, let's say, a wider network of routes and nodes that feeds me. So that has worked. The next focus for me in the next year is to get more focus on the program, to really focus on the things that are essential for Europe to have, or essential to keep, and also the industries that are essential to keep, where we have, let's say, winnable technologies. That's the second one. And my third objective is to assure that we also get a follow-up funding after the accelerator. Because the big weakness now of Europe is not, let's say, the valley of death. So we basically help companies through the valley of death, but they should not die at the end of it. And there they should get the funding to grow up. And that requires...
Preferably in Europe.
And they should scale up in Europe, because that's also where, I mean, what I often say is it's imagined by the few, but it should be made by the many for the many. So let's say any worker in 2030 should feel, yeah, okay, I'm building a machine, and that has been possible because 7 years ago, the owner of the factory got a grant to develop a new technology. And then the same thing, if the worker, man or woman, goes home and stops by the grocery, he should be able to buy something that has been developed with an EIC grant. So it should be felt in daily life, in work, and in shopping.
Right. And I also remember from a previous interview that there was this idea of increasing the maximum ticket from 15 million euros to 50 million euros by the...
Yeah, that's part of the uphill battle in the valley of death. Yeah, we need bigger tickets. And whether that is within the accelerator or a new instrument, that's a technical thing. But there is certainly a need of bigger tickets. And that requires us to work at an ecosystem of ourselves. And I think we have demonstrated to be able to be the first mover, and then to get along the VCs, the institutional investors, the national, regional, public banks, that we really create an ecosystem of scaling up capital. And the capital is there. Huh? We have
capital is there, but not within the EIC now. Now that I understand that the budget is actually lower this year than last year.
No, the budget is not there. Where the money is in all the savings Europeans have for their pensions.
Right.
Or their retirement.
So this conversation has been going on for years and years now, that we need to rope in the pension funds and the other similar players. What's so difficult about it? That's a very sort of dilettante question, but like, why has it been?
There are two difficulties. One, it is easy to talk about, but if you don't put money in the game, nothing happens. So what we have demonstrated is by putting money in the game, so 10 billion euros for the EIC, with the 10 billion, we have been able to attract other funding. If you don't put anything in, it's rhetoric. So by putting money in the game, we attracted others. And that's why STEP is an important step, because we will take a step into larger tickets also in order to seduce others into it. And the second thing is, yes, there are some institutional barriers. It is tougher for pension funds to invest in startup or in startup funds or in funds of funds. So there we have to remove a number of barriers and offer guarantees to do that.
Right. No, that all makes a lot of sense, of course. And when you look at the technologies that within the deep tech, but also outside the deep tech segment, what do you think are the most important ones for the European ecosystem and for you to for the EIC to focus on funding? If you look at verticals,
well, by far for me the first one is climate change. So everything by reducing fossil fuels for energy, and I think the focus is not on wind and sun, but mainly on let's say buffer energy sources when there's no wind or no sun. The second one in line of that is all kind of storage or conversion systems of storing energy in one form or another, not being hydroelectric. Water belts, but there's a whole range of technology being developed. Yeah. So that's one energy. Second one, materials. We should be less depending on imported materials. And the biggest challenge is to use our agriculture as a material base. And linked to that is also the protein transition that we should, we eat a bit too much meat. So have, let's say, alternative source of protein than meat. And so also to enable a transition of the agriculture. That is, I have a background also in that sector, having worked at one of the universities in agriculture. That's also an important one. And which is also a side effect, but not without importance, is that a big energy use is in information. So why is photonics important? Why is quantum important? Is by having a bigger processing ability of information with less energy. So those for me are the most essential ones.
Right. And one of the things that I've always been interested in, and something that I've been hearing about a lot over the past couple of years, is the importance of talent for the tech sovereignty of Europe.
Yep.
So how do we keep talent? How do we grow talent? How do we develop talent? Is this something that you're also working with and on?
Well, the Commission as a whole is working on it. What we see increasingly as an issue is that our beneficiaries, whether it's Pathfinder, Transition or Accelerator, cannot go faster because they lack the talent. So they sometimes even ask, well, be slower with your granting process because we have to recruit people to do the job. So yes, there is a shortage of technical talents, and that's something we really have to work at. So we first have to promote kids to choose for STEM topics at high school, then to go into universities in those. And what we also have to work at is a better, let's say, mobilization of those talents, because we still see that the majority of people with a technical degree go work in economic topics. So we also should attract them in technical skills. And I think it's also a challenge in assuring that across Europe, we have a balanced map. Fortunately, a lot of countries of Eastern Europe have a better mathematic, a physical and chemical training than in the west of Europe. So it's also important to mobilize all talents everywhere in Europe. And that's why widening is important, is because it's also giving opportunities to people to develop their skills and to develop companies in their own countries and not being forced to move to Sweden or Netherlands, but that would be a choice and not an obligation.
And when we talk about talent, another part of it is mental health. And for example, our friends over at another publication, Sifted, published a study just the other week talking about that almost half of founders in the UK were considering leaving their startup, like stopping, because of the mental health issues and issues connected to it. Is this also something that you are looking at? And is this something that you also heard about from the entrepreneurs when you were talking to them?
That's tough. I mean, we know in general that, of course, a very small percentage of startups across all sectors survive the first 5 years. So whether it's a mental problem or not a problem, I don't know. It can also be a financial problem that translates in mental care. It's not easy to be a starter. So it's very demanding. What we see in general, I was long of the school of, well, have startups survive in dark caves and wet ceilings. But I think a good care structure helps a lot. And a lot of that has been done in Europe with incubators, startup programs, accelerators, funding to make it more successful. So in general, you see the startups that have been supported by the system do better. They have success rate of around 50% survival after 5 years, where the average is below 20. And I see as well, with our beneficiaries, that having patient capital, having a runway with grant and equity of 5 to 7 years, that gives them a lot of relaxation and ability to focus on, well, really developing the company and not chasing after money all the time.
Absolutely. Okay, to wrap this up, I had another question, a different topic. So we just saw the AI Act having been finalized and signed and adopted. Does it change? What does it change for the EIC? Are you going to look differently at companies implementing AI and generative AI in particular?
Well, the most important thing of AI is of the AI Act is to have safeguards for the personal integrity of citizens. So where that is relevant, that has an impact. So for example, with health data, yeah, it is fair that health data is well protected and does not fall in the wrong hands. But a lot of AI has nothing to do with humans. It has to do with, for example, I met a company that looks at errors in machines. Mm-hmm. Or you can use AI to predict the behavior of polymers. Well, there's little privacy involved in those. And since we are going to promote essentially AI in those kind of applications, and so basically of understanding better the behavior of molecules, machine systems, there is little, let's say, privacy regulation. The privacy comes if you want to put a photo of Trump on the body of someone else, which is not advisable to do. Not in pictures and certainly not in reality. And also if you work with text or if you're infringing your intellectual property rights, there it is an issue. But I'm not going with the mood of, oh, the AI Act is going to stop the competitiveness of humans. No, competitiveness comes from fundamental understanding of fundamental phenomena. And that's what most of beneficiaries aim at.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much, Michiel. Thanks a lot for answering the questions. Thanks for taking the time to join the podcast. Good luck. And hopefully we talk again very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to Michiel once again for finding the time to come on the show, and also to all the organizers of the EIC Summit in Brussels, where this interview was recorded. At this point, this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us almost everywhere. Our music and sound engineering is done by SoundPulse. Please feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions and opinions at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am Andrei Degler.
I'm Linnea Avian.
And I'm Thomas McCauley.
Have a great week. Talk to you next Wednesday.
Bye.
Bye.